Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio.
Hello, you're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald.
Coming up, following a week in which the familiar world order was shaken to its core, we'll ask whether Europe and Ukraine can rely on the United States for security anymore, or if the continent needs to step up its defence spending. Is Donald Trump's relationship with Russia a threat to Europe?
We'll also ask whether Labour has an image problem, as their successes, like delivering 2 million more GP appointments, continue to go under the radar. Why is there so much negativity around this current Labour government? And does the Labour Party have an image problem?
As always, you can find us at Politics Uncensored UK on social media, all that and more coming up later in the programme.
But first, it's The Week Unwrapped.
A dictator without elections. Zelensky better move fast or he's not going to have a country left. Got to move fast because that war is going in the wrong direction. In the meantime, we're successfully negotiating an end to the war with Russia, something I'll admit that only Trump is going to be able to do in the Trump administration. We're going to be able to do it. I think Putin even admitted that. Biden never tried. Europe has failed to bring peace, and Zelensky probably wants to keep the gravy train going. I don't know what's the problem, but he hasn't been able. He's very upset that he wasn't invited. He could have come if he wanted to, but that he wasn't invited to Saudi Arabia. But he's been working for 3 years. There's never been even meetings or phone calls to stop this war. It's a horrible thing.
That was Donald Trump, you heard correctly, suggesting that the man fighting to maintain Ukrainian sovereignty and democracy is, quote, a dictator. Well, the Prime Minister has backed Volodymyr Zelensky as a democratically elected leader after President Trump's comments. Keir Starmer called Zelensky on Wednesday evening and told him it was perfectly reasonable for Ukraine to suspend elections during wartime as the UK did during World War II, Downing Street has said. The US president has earlier criticised Zelensky, saying he had done a terrible job and claiming he refuses to have elections in Ukraine. Zelensky's five-year term was due to end in May 2024, but elections have been suspended since martial law was declared after Russia's invasion. Keir will travel to Washington, D.C. next week for his first in-person meeting with Trump. The PM has said he wants to use his meeting next week to discuss a U.S. backstop that he says is necessary to deter Russia from attacking Ukraine again. Keir has also said he would be prepared to deploy British troops to Ukraine to help guarantee its security as part of a peace deal, provided there was a US backstop. But the deepening rift between the US and Ukraine has now increased the political jeopardy for him. Ali, it's been a really unbelievable week that has changed the world order in ways we've not really seen since the end of the Cold War, not least as the US has seemingly allowed Russia to dictate the optics of negotiations around the end of the war in Ukraine. Where do we go from here?
Look, I think if I was on the Ukrainian side, I'd be extremely concerned, not least because the amount of support financially through weapons, munitions and other things that the United States provides Ukraine is hugely important in their ability, their tangible reality on the battlefield, on the ground. And Donald Trump seems to be quite keen to follow sort of Russian talking points and has clearly broken with European leaders and sort of Western allied powers on Ukraine specifically. So I think this is what we feared and suspected in the election campaign, which is that there is going to be a serious break between the United States' support for Europe's security and defense. That's certainly happening now. So much of Europe and Ukraine have been scrambling over the last couple of days about what that future looks like and how Europe can defend itself. There is no question that the Russian President Donald Trump, I mean, the United States President Donald Trump, seems to be taking in, like, hook, line and sinker, the Russian talking points.
And this concept of a backstop that Keir Starmer has put forward, which he says is needed for a Ukraine mm-hmm. deal to stop Russia returning. What do you think that could look like? I mean, what is it you think that Ukraine might want, and what is realistic when it comes to stopping Russia from attacking its neighbour again?
So, yeah, to be clear on the backstop, for folks who don't understand, what Starmer is asking for and what the Ukrainians are asking for is a guarantee from the United States that, say, a ceasefire was agreed and the war was to come to an end, that in 2, 3, 4 years, Russia wasn't reinvading Ukraine after it's been able to rearm itself and to rebuild some of the elements of its military, which have broken down as a result of the war. What that would likely look like is troops on the ground in key areas. So what you would essentially say is you would have US, UK, so allied military bases in key areas of territory, which would make essentially an invasion of Ukraine in the future in essence, invasion of the United States military bases and others. So that's what they mean by a backstop. I think Keir Starmer had spoken about sort of British troops on the ground, and I think a lot of people mistook that for we're going to go into the front, we're going to send British troops onto the front line to fight Ukraine on behalf of Ukraine and fight the Russians now. That's not what was being suggested. What was being suggested was British troops on the ground as a guarantee to stop future invasion. This is extremely serious, I think, and it is a sort of recalibration of the world order, and Europe seems to be scrambling now as to how it deals with future security risks, and it'll have serious, some people might look at this as a foreign policy issue, but it's going to have serious consequences here, because there is already a lot of noise that we need to increase defence spending to about 5%. We're on 2.3%, the aim is 2.5%, and obviously that money has to come from somewhere, and a lot of, I know certainly the military-industrial complex, the military establishment are definitely sort of in the camp that says it should be 5%, and that's going to have real impacts on our economy here.
So what do you think's going on with Trump's attacks, which seem to have really ramped up on Zelensky this week? You know, previously Trump was pretty supportive of Zelensky, and in fact support for Zelensky has been unanimous pretty much throughout Europe, the UK. It's one of the things that's united former prime ministers, and of course in the US as well. We saw Biden was very supportive of Zelensky, but Trump has really kind of turned up the heat, called Zelensky a dictator. What do you think he's trying to do here?
So I think calling Zelensky a dictator is just like personal immaturity from Trump. I don't think that actually is a political strategy. What happened was Trump, the US team went to Saudi Arabia and met with Putin, which, by the way, the wildest thing, to end a war between Ukraine and Russia, the discussions didn't even have Ukraine at the table. In response to that, Zelensky said, I think I'm paraphrasing, but that Donald Trump was swimming in the disinformation sort of swamp. And Trump has hit back on him in his usual sort of childish.
So do you think this is, he's affronted by what he perceives as a personal attack on Zelensky?
Yeah, I think the dictator line is, but in terms of why Trump has reached this position, there are lots of schools of thoughts and lots of doctrine. The two that I have seen and heard most seriously is that, one, Trump is kind of in legacy mode. I've actually heard from quite a few people that he's quite keen to win a Nobel Peace Prize because Obama won one. And he's been obsessed with Obama from the beginning.
Yeah, Obama,
right?
Yeah.
And that's largely because this all started with Obama making fun of him at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. That's what started the whole presidential campaign. And he thinks that by ending wars, he'll get a Nobel Peace Prize. And so he wants to end the war come what may. So he doesn't really care how it happens. He just wants the war to end. And he knows that the way to do that is to negotiate with the Russians. And so there's a school of thought that says this isn't actually being driven by anything other than Trump wanting to look the peacemaker and ending the war. But he also does want to sort of detach the amount of money that the US spends in Ukraine. The other theory is that he's compromised, that the Russians have something compromised. This has been a rumor since his first presidential campaign, that the Russians in some way, shape or form have compromised him, and that's why he's running these.
Okay, well, from one American saying something that you wouldn't believe to another.
In Britain and across Europe, free speech, I fear, is in retreat. And in the interest of comedy, my friends, but also in the interest of truth, I will admit that sometimes the loudest voices for censorship have come not from within Europe, but from within my own country, where the prior administration threatened and bullied social media companies to censor so-called misinformation. Misinformation like, for example, the idea that coronavirus had likely leaked from a laboratory in China. Our own government encouraged private companies to silence people who dared to utter what turned out to be an obvious truth. So I come here today not just with an observation, but with an offer. And just as the Biden administration seemed desperate to silence people for speaking their minds, so the Trump administration will do precisely the opposite, and I hope that we can work together on that. In Washington, there is a new sheriff in town. And under Donald Trump's leadership, we may disagree with your views, but we will fight to defend your right to offer it in the public square, agree or disagree.
That was US Vice President J.D. Vance, who says he will reiterate his concerns about the erosion of free speech in Britain to Keir Starmer, with a pair meet in Washington next week. The Vice President used his recent speech at the Munich Security Conference to warn that the erosion of free speech and mass migration in Europe pose a greater threat to the continent than Russia. Singling out the UK, he said that free speech was, quote, in retreat, and that Brexit voters had been betrayed by elites opening the floodgates to millions of unvetted immigrants. He continued, We're simply telling them to respect our values on which our civilization was founded, that you ought to debate with one another. Your government should respect when the people have a dissenting viewpoint. Mr. Vance also added that the backlash to his comments from some of our European friends suggests they've taken too much leadership from the Biden administration and leaned too much into the censorship regime. Ali, his speech went down extremely badly amongst European leaders, not least because he suggested that the erosion of free speech was a greater threat than Russia or China. Does he have a point? Is free speech on the retreat in Europe?
No. First of all, J.D. Vance lecturing us about free speech is like the wolf lecturing the sheep about attacking others. You don't know what J.D. Vance and his administration have been up to since they got into power, if we're going to talk about free speech. The Trump administration decided to limit Associated Press reporters' access to the White House press corps over their coverage of the Gulf of America stories and the conversations around Gulf of America. Elon Musk, who is, I think, shadow president of the United States, called for, quote, long prison sentences for CBS journalists because he didn't like the edits that they were making. And Mr. Musk also called for the jailing of American journalists because they're apparently dissenting views on TV interviews he didn't like.
They're also suing journalists for libel. They've also removed references to LGBT resources from government websites. They've also told government employees to not refer to gender ideology. They've also removed all the books, or certain books, sorry, from children who are taught in the Pentagon to basically assess how much D&I, diversity and inclusion references there are in there. I mean, it's almost like free speech, but only the speech I have endorsed.
Yeah, and we've spoken about this on the show before. I don't think anyone takes them seriously as free speech champions. And what's funny is that the sort of hard right only scream free speech when it infringes on speech they don't like, that they do like. When it's a speech that they don't like, they're very happy for it to be curtailed and limited. And what we should be clear about is this wasn't a speech about free speech, and this isn't a fight by the hard right on free speech. It's a fight on sort of hard right politics, extreme right wing politics, in some cases out and out fascism. And it's no surprise, and people like Elon Musk and to a certain degree J.D. Vance like to present themselves as common sense independents who have fallen into Republican parties and others because the left have become so extreme on issues like DEI and other social issues. That's just not true. If you look at the things that they are advocating across the board, it is the playbook of the hard right. Why is Elon Musk endorsing the AfD in Germany? Why was he saying that Keir Starmer is complicit in the sort of what was the rape of Britain or whatever quotes.
Why did he do a Nazi salute on stage?
Yeah, these aren't free speech campaigners. Yeah. These aren't free speech champions. They're just classic archetypal hard right extreme right activists who are just wearing the cloak of free speech. So if JD Vance thinks that Europe is going to take any lectures from him, his extreme right wing cabal, and their sort of faux outrage over freedom of speech, he's got another thing coming. I will also remind JD Vance that he can't really talk about civilizations being founded, given that the government that he's in and the country that he's in was invented 200 years ago. So we're not exactly talking about civilization here.
Do you think... So one of the things he talked about was buffer zones, right? This was one of his examples of free speech being curtailed here in the UK. He spoke about a man who, I believe in Scotland, who was arrested for praying within a 200-metre buffer zone outside an abortion clinic. He basically said this man was being peaceful, he wasn't harming anyone, and he got arrested. Well, actually, he'd contravened the buffer zone, which is, you know, which is a legal thing we have here. And
can we tell people why we have buffer zones?
Well, exactly. Because we don't want women shouldn't be intimidated when they're trying to seek
medical care.
The other thing I don't understand is, if prayer is so powerful, why can't you do it in your own home?
No, there's a signal. God doesn't hear the signal.
Yes, okay. In the buffer zone.
Yeah, how it's, you know how you have 4G and 5G and 3G?
Yes.
You have to be within a certain, otherwise it doesn't, the electromagnet, Earth is flat.
Thank you for explaining that to me, one religious person to a non-religious person. I just think this is so ridiculous, and it needs to be called out, because what I am actually seeing is the weaponization. It's creeping in, and I don't think it's long till Nigel Farage starts parroting these lines where they start going for reproductive rights here in the UK. Yeah, and I think this is the opening of it. Targeting buffer zones is going to start to rekindle that debate around reproductive rights, I think, here in the UK. Yeah.
And we're already seeing a lot of these right-wing UK politicians parroting Trump. They've seen a successful playbook. He used it. He's gotten into government. He's gotten into power. He's got a huge social movement behind him of like right-wing Republicans. And you can already see the likes of Farage, Rupert Lowe, 30p Lee trying to be the sort of pound shop JD and Donald Trump's.
Well, we'll watch this space, but I think a lot of this rhetoric is going to start creeping into UK politics. Okay, that is The Week Unwrapped. Coming up, we'll talk more about Ukraine's future and the talks to end Russian aggression in the country with Ukrainian MP Alexei Goncharenko. That's next on Politics Uncensored.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio. That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on Fubar Radio.
I am joined now by Ricardo Mighty. He is the CEO of Mighty Labs.
I just think if you're going to get into crypto, you just can't think short term. If you're trying to, I don't know, like pay your bills next month and you think I'm going to invest in crypto this month and then I'm going to take the gains out and do something with, you just can't think like that, because 99.9% of the time, the market doesn't work the way you want it to work. It works how it's going to work. The longer you have your investment in crypto, most likely the better it will do.
You're listening to Fubar Radio. Download our app now to listen to your favorite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all Fubar shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app. Just search for Fubar Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores. Yay! The Fubar Radio app. Get it today. Get it today.
It was calm on the beach, so I took my little girl out on the water. Then we hit the wind, and it blew us out to sea, faster than we could paddle back. And we learned our lesson from these guys, the crew who got us home. Thank you.
Respect the water and watch out for the winds. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
Registering to vote means you can take part in the way decisions are made in the UK. When you register to vote, you are then able to cast your vote at local and national elections. You can help choose who runs your area and makes decisions about things you care about. Millions of people in the UK aren't registered to vote, and they miss out on having their voice heard. It's quick and easy to register. It only takes 5 minutes. You can do it online, or you can ask for a paper form at your local council. Register to vote now at gov.uk/register-to-vote.
What the hell with Gabby Allen.
Mr. Later Williams, hello. Mate, can we just address that you did Strictly Come Dancing?
I know, people were quite upset about that, to be fair, but listen, not the first musical theatre performer to be on Strictly, won't be the last. I've never watched a full season from the start to the end. So when it actually got to it, I was like, whoa, like there's so many different styles. I was like, oh, and Nikita, I love him, but he was really pushing me to be the best that I could be.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
We've got Miss Chloe Brockett in the studio.
It got to the point where I wasn't enjoying it as much as I used to. I used to love it. You know, it was my life. I wasn't in relationships because I was going on TOWIE. I wasn't, you know, invested in anything other than the show because I loved it so much. And then as I got older, I just didn't enjoy it anymore. I noticed that the cast around me had changed. All the OGs had gone and I'd all of a sudden become an OG at 23. And was a bit like, you know what, I don't think this is for me anymore.
Follow us at Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald. Now, back to the conflict in Ukraine.
I think I have the power to end this war. And I think it's going very well. But today I heard, oh, well, we weren't invited. Well, you've been there for 3 years. You should have ended it 3 years. You should have never started it. You could have made a deal. I could have made a deal for Ukraine that would have given them almost all of the land, everything, almost all of the land, and no people would have been killed and no city would have been demolished and not one dome would have been knocked down. But they chose not to do it that way.
That was US President Donald Trump speaking earlier this week. Well, joining us now on the programme to discuss this is Alexei Goncharenko, a Ukrainian MP from the European Solidarity Party, who is also the President of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe's Migration Committee. Alexei, thank you for joining us. Tell me, when you first heard President Trump suggest that Ukraine was responsible for starting this war, how did you feel?
Hi. You know, first of all, he didn't say this like directly. I didn't like part of his comments for sure. But I just want to explain you that what's going on now here in Ukraine is too serious. I just don't want to deepen all this crisis that we have. We already have a very deep crisis in our relationships with the United States. And United States are the most important military ally for Ukraine. So just to give words, who is right, who is not, and all this stuff, to give assessments of Donald Trump and anything else, we just dying here every day. And we need to U.S. to be with us, and we need to speak with any American president whom Americans select. Now it's Donald Trump. He will be president for 4 years ahead, and we can't lose him. We can't lose these allies. So this is much more important than do I like his comments or do I don't like his comments. That doesn't matter.
Alexei, I wanted to ask about not necessarily the actual comments themselves, but the implications of them. Donald Trump has made it quite clear in these negotiations that there will likely have to be concessions on land from the Ukrainian side. Can you give us an insight on the feeling within the political leadership of Ukraine, but also the people of Ukraine? Is that a possibility that's willing to be entertained, that Ukraine might concede some land in exchange for peace?
We need to give a term. What does it mean, concede? Because I will now explain you my position. What do I want as Ukrainian and all Ukrainians, believe me? We want to win the war, kick out aggressor from our territory, restore our territorial integrity, period. That's what we want. Do we have it today? No. Can we do it today without Western support? No. Do we have enough Western support to do it now? No. So what should we do? And what deal should be? I think there are, as for any country, there are three main things. There is independence, there is sovereignty, there is territorial integrity. I think independence of Ukraine is out of any risk. Even Putin now realizes he can't destroy Ukraine, and Ukraine showed to the whole world that we are ready to protect our country, and Ukraine will exist. So next question is territorial integrity. Yes, today we don't have it. 20% of our territories are occupied, and it looks like it is possible that they will be occupied for some time. I don't know, one day, 10 years, I don't know for how long. But what is important for us, that we will never accept juridically that these lands are Russian. These lands are Ukrainian. This is our territory. And sooner or later, this Russian empire, the last colonial empire in Europe, will fall apart and we will regain control of our territories. So for us, important is that we do not accept that this is in Russian. Yes, but unfortunately, it looks like they will be for some time controlled by Russia. Mm. It happens.
Alexei, can I just ask a quick follow-up?
The main thing, and now I'm finishing, is sovereignty. Today, it's the main thing that Ukraine is a sovereign state which has a right to make sovereign decision. What army to have, where to move, what alliances to join. That's the most important for us, and we need to protect it in any possible deal, accompanied with security guarantees.
Keir Starmer has spoken, and Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister here in the UK, has spoken about the importance of a backstop, so that if a deal is done, Russia will not once again invade Ukraine. What to you does a backstop look like? What should it include?
The best backstop is membership. Number one. If not, a direct treaty with the United States and other major military powers, UK, France, about a kind of United States has with Japan and with South Korea. That's the second option. Third option is some complex of things, including boots on the ground. There are some innovative things, like, for example, American Republican Senator Lindsey Graham proposed, and he says that it has some support in White House, that, for example, if Russia will attack again, Ukraine will automatically become a member of NATO, something like this. So it can be different things, but the best thing would be membership in NATO. Mm.
Alexei, there's been a lot of conversation in the UK about the future of European defence as well as Ukrainian defence, given that there seems to be a shift from the US president in the future of the United States' sort of integration into European defence. If we aren't able to reach a peace deal, can Ukraine continue to defend itself without the deep support that the United States has provided if Donald Trump decides to turn off that tap and just with European support, or are we in serious trouble if he decides to do this?
We are in very serious trouble. This is a very bad scenario. But if it would happen, and I hope it will never happen, but if it would happen, we will continue to defend our country. I just want to remind you, 3 years ago, it was not American soldiers who stopped Russians in Ukraine. It was Ukrainian soldiers with just Ukrainian weapon. Because at that moment, we received almost nothing with Western weaponry, very small amounts. So we did it ourselves. After 3 years of war, yes, we're tired. Yes, we're exhausted. Yes, we lost people and territories. But we have battle-hardened army. Our military production is much higher. We are prepared to fight. I think we are stronger than we were 3 years ago. So we can continue fight even without U.S. support. But this is a very bad scenario, and I don't want, because this scenario will mean more, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people will die. This is very bad.
One last question from me, Alexei, if I may. Donald Trump has decided to personally attack the Ukrainian leader, Zelensky. And obviously, I don't want to deal with the personal attack because that's not useful for anyone. But our British audience might like to know what's the feeling in Ukraine around the Ukrainian president and his support within Ukraine?
Oh, it definitely has bigger support than 4%. But at the same time, I have a lot of questions to Zelensky, too. How he prepared country for the war, about some of his decisions, about how country is managed today. So I think definitely Zelensky is legitimate president of Ukraine. Definitely we don't like when anybody else give assertions to him, because it's Ukrainian people who should give him assertion, and is it good or not. But I can tell you, and I should tell you this, that some comments of President Zelensky, which he is doing in the last days, are also not very wise to do. He should be cold-blooded. We should be super calm. We should remember that any word said can cost a lot of human lives. We can't lose any lives anymore. We lost too much already, too many.
Alexei, would you like to see an election in Ukraine in the near future?
Well, elections are just physically impossible today. It's impossible. We can have elections, and we should have elections, after we will be end of hostilities and security guarantees, which will prevent Russians from attacking us exactly the day when we will go to polling stations.
And can I ask, The mood in Ukraine right now, 3 years of war, I don't imagine it's good. But how are the Ukrainian people holding up with what must be an extremely difficult couple of years, few years?
We are holding up. It was very difficult years. And I wish that no other country in the world would go through this. But we don't have any other option. This is our country. This is our land. We will protect it. We want our children to live here. And then their children, and so on. So we will fight till the end.
Alexei, final question from me. What would you say to Donald Trump and the West now? What is your final plea to them before we end this interview?
My plea is very easy. You need us. Yes, we need you desperately to survive. But you also need us. 1 million battle-hardened people, one of the biggest food producers in the world, country which showed that we are ready to die for the values which we share with you. So it's not about moral even. It's pragmatic choice to help us to survive in order then to have a very strong ally which will help to survive in the free world.
Thank you very much. That was Alexei Goncharenko, a Ukrainian MP from the European Solidarity Party. He's also the president of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe's Migration Committee.
It's Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald with Politics Uncensored. FUBAR Radio.
So, Ali, we just heard from the Ukrainian MP, Alexei Goncharenko, there. What did you make of what he had to say?
I think the part that was really interesting to me is he kind of danced beyond Donald Trump's sort of comments around Zelensky, Russia, Ukraine, and the peace efforts. The most interesting thing for me was the sort of implicit criticism of Zelensky's response to what's been going on. Alexei seemed far more sort of realpolitik. We need American support. There's no point in picking a fight here, which Zelensky has clearly done in response to Donald Trump's negotiations with Russia when he talked about him living in sort of disinformation space. And it sounds like to me that Ukraine cannot survive its resistance efforts, its defense efforts, in the way that it is now anyway, without American support. He sounded very worried to me about America turning off that tap, and therefore he was quite critical of his own president during wartime, criticizing a foreign leader who has outwardly attacked Ukraine for fear of them turning off that cap. What did you think?
Yeah, I agree. I think it was pretty clear that he didn't want this interview to be a chance for us to get a clip, for example, of him criticising Donald Trump. And I can understand that. I think there is a lot of concern in Ukrainian circles about what sort of leader Trump is, you know, how actually reactive he is to personal attacks, how something like that could change the outcome of this war, and how actually all of this needs to go above and beyond the people and, you know, be about Ukraine and the future of Ukraine. He also underlined absolutely that Ukraine, the best backstop they can have is membership of NATO, which we know is one of the most, on the other side, is one of the most provocative things for Russia.
Yeah, Putin will just never accept that.
So I thought it was really interesting. I also thought it was, you know, you're right, he was, he wasn't absolutely 100% supportive of everything Zelensky has said and done, but there was that sense of, I don't want to attack Zelensky either, because this, you know, it's interesting when you actually talk to somebody who is in a country that is suffering war, they don't want to get into the personality. They want to talk about the future of the country, the safety. And that argument that he made at the end, which wasn't the moral argument for defending Ukraine, it was the pragmatic argument for defending Ukraine, which was about their food supplies, energy, all the things that Ukraine can do for the rest of the world. That actually might be the more successful argument to someone like Trump, who is a businessman first and foremost. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have the sort of ethical the ethical backdrop that some politicians operate by. Perhaps that is the approach that Ukrainian officials would like to take when dealing with Donald Trump, as opposed to just that kind of moral narrative we've had throughout the West, which is that we stand with Ukraine because that is the right thing to do. Because clearly that isn't working in this new age of politics where leaders don't really subscribe to that anymore.
Yeah, you know, I was going to ask him, my first question I was going to ask him was, do you think Donald Trump is still an ally to Ukraine? Not the United States, but is Donald Trump an ally to the United States? But given his answer to your first question, I kind of binned that because I thought he's not going to answer that given what he's just said. But what concerns me is he's an MP in Ukraine. He's clearly very clued into the machinations of the war, what's going on, and what the front line kind of looks like. It sounded like to me he doesn't believe that just with European support, Ukraine could hold off Russia.
No.
Which is a concern to all of Europe, really. If a Ukrainian leader who's there and witnessing the sort of the war day to day doesn't think Europe in its entirety is enough to hold back Russia, given the noises that Donald Trump has been making, that should that not be a concern for us, do you think?
I got that impression as well. Yeah. I think clearly there is a sense that the US holds all the cards here, which is why it is incredibly concerning that those cards are held by Donald Trump.
Yeah.
But I thought, it was always fascinating to hear from an MP on the front line there. I'm sure we'll keep an eye on that. And we will be discussing this a lot more over the coming weeks. Coming up, they've got wages to outpace inflation and successfully delivered 2 million more GP appointments. But it's not the positivity and instead the negativity surrounding the current Labour government that is cutting through. Does Labour have an image problem? All that and more next.
Fubar Radio. That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on Fubar Radio.
I am joined now by Ricardo Mighty. He is the CEO of Mighty Labs.
I just think if you're going to get into crypto, you just can't think short term. If you're trying to, pay your bills next month and you think I'm going to invest in crypto this month and then I'm going to take the gains out and do something with, you just can't think like that because 99.9% of the time, the market doesn't work the way you want it to work. It works how it's going to work. The longer you have your investment in crypto, most likely the better it will do.
You're listening to Fubar Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all Fubar shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for Fubar Radio on the Apple and Google app stores.
Yeah. The Fubar Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
Is the sound of your mates alive? Is getting to more gigs this year and the next? Is the sound of saying, I got you, mate? Is the sound of mates enjoying even more of this? Is the sound of mates getting home instead of here? Click your seatbelt, because you're twice as likely to be killed or seriously injured if you don't think.
When you notice something wrong, it tends to grow and eventually take over to the point you can't really think of anything else. If something in your body doesn't feel right, the thought it could be cancer can play on your mind. Tests could put your mind at rest. Finding out sooner is always better. Your NHS wants to see you. Contact your GP practice.
What the hell with Gabby Allen.
Mr. Later Williams, hello. Mate, can we just address that you did Strictly Come Dancing?
I know, people were quite upset about that, to be fair. But listen, not the first musical theatre performer to be on Strictly. Won't be the last. I've never watched a full season from the start to the end. So when it actually got 2 hours, I was like, whoa, like there's so many different styles. I was like, oh. And Nikita, I love him, but he was really pushing me to be the best that I could be.
Access All Areas with Bobby Norris.
We've got Miss Chloe Brockett in the studio.
It got to the point where I wasn't enjoying it as much as I used to. I used to love it. You know, it was my life. I wasn't in relationships because I was going on TOWIE. I wasn't, you know, invested in anything other than the show because I loved it so much. And then as I got older, I just didn't enjoy it anymore. I noticed that the cast around me had changed. All the OGs had gone and I'd all of a sudden become an OG at 23 and was a bit like, you know what, I don't think this is for me anymore.
Politics Uncensored on Fubar Radio.
You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald. OK, does Labour have an image problem? Let's talk about it. Well, for one, average wages are continuing to outpace inflation, with pay packets rising for both public and private sector workers, according to official figures. Pay, after considering the pace of price rises, rose 3.5% 4% between October and December compared with the same period a year ago, according to the Office for National Statistics. The UK's unemployment rate remains unchanged at 4.4%, so Labour is doing pretty well on wages, but that's not cutting through. Well, how about GP appointments? The government has met a first key election pledge to deliver 2 million extra NHS appointments in England in its first year, the Prime Minister has said. The target was achieved between July and November last year, when there were almost 2.2 million more elective care appointments compared to the same period in 2023, according to official figures. Another success, but it's not cutting through. There wasn't much fanfare around it, and instead, the overwhelming picture of the Labour government right now seems rather negative. Recent polling suggests that almost half of Britons think the government is doing a bad job. And as we know, Labour have fallen behind Reform UK in the national opinion rankings. So, Ali, you're our Labour guy. What's wrong with your party? Why does it have an image problem?
I'm just looking up the approval ratings because I'm curious as to where we stand live. Oh, we've got them here. So look, the thing that I feared, I think, has come to true in that as much as people early on in an administration might say that there's a long way to go and we'd do the unpopulist things first, when people make up their mind about you, it's very difficult to then overcome that at any stage. Mm. And Rishi Sunak found that out, I think, pretty quickly. And then confirmation bias kicks in. So there's an element of a large portion of voters have decided what they think about Keir Starmer's administration. And it's then not impossible, not even extremely difficult, but quite difficult to overcome that once people have made up their minds. Over half of Britons are disappointed with Labour's performance at 56%, with fewer than one in five feeling pleased. So that's 18%. That's one issue. Now, I actually think Labour's image problem is one of our own making, and that is our obsession with allowing our opposition and our political opponents to define the scope of the debate. So there are some good newses for Labour, not least what you've just spoken about, the wages outpacing price rises. Inflation kind of took a bump to 3%, but it's still well below what it was peak under Conservatives, and 2.2 million new elective care appointments in the NHS 7 months early is genuinely impressive. Now, if I was running Labour's communication strategy, what I would be doing is shouting particularly about the NHS success at every single opportunity. I would be telling every member of the Labour Party, every councillor, every MP, every media appearance that they do, even if they're taking their dog on a walk, to be telling other dogs about these 2 million extra appointments.
2 million, yeah.
But what are we doing instead of that? We're focusing on, well, first of all, the Russia stuff has kind of knocked them off course. That's not their fault. That is circumstance. But also, we spent much of last week talking about deportations. It seems like rather than shouting about this, Labour are looking at live streaming people getting deported and putting out reform stuff. So
I wonder if there's a sort of broader image problem here, which is that they have kind of leaned into the sort of joyless party, right? So deportations,
pessimism.
Some people might like that. Some people might, you know, put their fist in the air when they see someone get bundled into a van and sent back to their home country. I don't. And I think a lot of people find that kind of slightly bleak, even if they do, even if they are, you know, potentially quite anti-immigration. But there's other stuff as well, isn't there? You know, there's the cracking down on smoking and on junk food. There's the removing the winter fuel allowance from pensioners. It's all a bit, you know, there's the doom and gloom around the economy. It's all a bit joyless.
Yeah.
And I do wonder if part of that makes people A, disengage, but also just makes people think this government isn't making my life any happier.
Yeah.
And I think we don't talk about happiness enough in politics. I think it's seen as a kind of a nice to have, when actually research shows again and again, happy electorates vote their incumbent governments back in. So and you know, when Starmer, I think it was back in 2019, Starmer made a pledge, which was that he would make sure that for every pound spent by the Treasury, a certain amount, and I don't know the figure off the top of my head, would be invested into people's well-being. He had this kind of well-being focused kind of politics that he was interested in and seems to have gone out the window. And there is stuff like the Employment Rights Bill, which I think genuinely could make people's lives feel securer and could improve their well-being. You could probably say the same about the Rent Reform Bill. But what? Why don't governments care about making electorates happier, do you think?
That's a really, really interesting point. First of all, I think there's so many different things linked to it. I think part of the problem Labour has is actually the people doing the communicating. The two major voices of this government are Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves. Not great communicators.
They actually have very similar voices.
They do have quite... and neither is
I think
good.
They had the same voice code.
Yeah. did they Zoom or did they come in person? So I think part of the problem is when Boris Johnson was in power, he had this remarkable ability to be optimistic, upbeat. Actually, that has huge advantages in the economy. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think you've hit the nail on right. I hadn't even thought about this until today, until you've just mentioned it. But it's quite hard when... the messenger isn't the best communicator, isn't the most charismatic, both of them in Rachel and Keir Starmer, but also the strategy is quite gloomy, kind of overcast British weather type.
Yeah,
right. It is difficult for people to feel optimistic about the future because the government don't seem optimistic about the future. So why should I? Happiness is a really interesting point because I think it is almost universally ignored in political discussions that I have. So whenever I'm in if I'm in discussions with Labour Party officials, whether I'm in local authorities, number 10, whatever, I've never once heard someone talk about the happiness index or the way that happiness is measured and whether people feel the impacts of the work you're doing. And we often say cut through, right? What we mean by cut through is, okay, wages are out sort of pacing rises in prices. We've got 2.2 million more appointments. But do people feel that?
Do people feel richer?
Yeah.
Do people feel the benefit of their nan going to the GP, getting her treatment, and then she's happier.
It's someone coming home from their appointment going, bloody hell, that was quicker than I thought it was going to be. I don't think that's happening. But on the happiness index, this is actually measured. Mm. And the UK has fallen to 20th in the happiness index in the way that it is recorded. Folks can look at it. Britain dropped one place from 2023. The 2025 ratings haven't come down yet. But, for example, Finland, Denmark, Iceland, Sweden, Israel, although Israel, this is pre-war, Netherlands, Norway, Luxembourg, Switzerland, Australia, all these countries outpace England, the United Kingdom as a whole, in happiness. And I think you have hit the nail quite well on the head there. I think there's a gloom in the country.
I would bet you that what those countries have in common. Just read me a couple of them again.
Let's have a look here.
Read me the top five.
Top five is Finland at one, Denmark at two, Iceland at three, Sweden at four, Israel at five.
Okay, so I don't know much about Israel's domestic politics, but I would wager that those four economies have very strong workers' rights. Mm-hmm. They have a strong socially democratic state. They have good public services. And I think they have good gender equality as well.
And workplace laws, right?
This is what I mean. So this is something that Labour maybe should be making more of a fuss of. Stop worrying about the right-wing papers saying that people aren't getting back to the office and realise the link between happy, productive workforces and strengthened employment rights.
Yeah, do you want to... Sorry, I'm looking at this. I'm really sorry. Do you want to guess who the least happy countries in the world
is? Is it the USA?
It's not. No. It's what you think it is. Take a quick guess.
Oh, is it Palestine?
No, Afghanistan.
Afghanistan. Okay.
Along with Lebanon, Lesotho, Sierra Leone, and Democratic Republic of Congo.
War-torn countries. Yes. Okay. So, I mean, yes. At least we're not. Well, we may be at war soon, from the conversation we'd be having earlier. But I do think there is something to be said that this government should maybe think about ways they can improve people's lives. There's a conversation the other week that was going on in the background, which always reemerges, about the 4-day week. Mm. And there's lots of economic arguments people love to make about how the 4-day week would ruin the economy, make everyone's lives way worse. But actually, when you look at the trial of the 4-day week, the majority of companies kept doing it because it worked for them. I mean, it won't work in every industry, of course, but people were more productive, they worked harder, they were healthier, they were happier, they stayed with the company for longer, the companies didn't see any change to their profit margins. Mm. That's the sort of policy. I'm not saying adopt the 4-day week, but that is the sort of policy that I think would make people feel happier?
Yeah, you know, I work a 4-day week. So I changed about, I want to say June, July last year to a 4-day week. So I don't work on Fridays now. And yeah, it's immensely...
Changes your life, yeah.
The way, yeah, yeah. Like, it allows for that Friday for you to kind of unload some of your personal life admin and stuff like that. So can I ask you a question, not as journalist, Zoe, host Zoe, all that kind of stuff? Because what I'm looking at here, one of the things that the articles I'm reading are saying is actually our number in terms of the happiness index is plummeting because of young people. So 18 to 30-year-olds are more unhappy than over 65-year-olds.
But you know what I'm going to say about this, don't
housing.
No. Well, I was actually going to say ban the smartphones.
Right.
But yes, I mean, yeah, housing. So a lot of it is their life prospects, yeah. Obviously. Housing, the future, the cost of education.
Would you say you're optimistic about the future of the country?
No.
Okay, and what would Labour need to do to change that?
I think... I'm lucky because I'm on the housing ladder. But if I wasn't, I'd feel very, very worried because I'd feel like all the things I want to do in my future, like having children or, you know, just having a nice house where I can go and have enough money to go on holiday once a year, feeling secure to live a standard of life that I thought I would get if I worked hard.
Yeah.
I think that would be challenged. So I think building more houses is a massive part of that. That needs to be done sort of as quickly, as thoroughly as possible. But I also think, you know, I imagine what's going on in the rest of the world impacts people's mental health. I think smartphones are a massive depressive force on young people's mental health. I mean, the sort of, we've talked about it a lot, but the content they're subjected to.
Yeah.
You know, I think about young women and the content they're subjected to, how I would feel as a young woman having that on my phone all day long. So I think there are lots of things like that. And yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, the mental health of young people in this country has plummeted. And I'm sure that is impacting it. So I wonder if the government need to stop being so gloomy and think about little things they can do. How about extending licensing laws?
Yeah.
Getting nightlife going again.
Yeah, you know what? Me and a few friends went to Seville a few years ago, and one of the things we noticed when we were on holiday was you could just sit in cafes till like 1 a.m.
Yeah.
And
we're not
drinking alcohol.
No.
I mean, we're all Muslim, but we were just chilling, playing cards, and there was just a very nice vibe that London just doesn't have.
This is the other thing. Closure of those third spaces or the inaccessible cost rising of those third spaces for young people. So now, if you're a young person, where do you actually go to hang out with your friends?
Yeah.
Where do you go that doesn't cost money? A lot of people can't.
Where do we go? No. Where do you go? People's houses.
I don't really hang out with
them. Because
it's all very expensive. Yeah. I mean, last night I hung out with some friends. I went round to her house. She's lucky enough to have her own house where she can host people. But if she lived in a flat share or if she lived with her parents, she'd struggle.
The only time we ever saw friends was football on a Friday. Otherwise, otherwise you have to spend money. That's the other problem. Like,
you have to spend
a lot of money, and then you have to leave by. So we used to go to a restaurant that was open till 1 a.m. because it was the only restaurant. So I think those licensing laws are a really interesting point of being able to, you know, extend.
You know how you do that?
How do you
smash the NIMBYs.
Oh,
the best way to make this country happier is to smash the NIMBYs. Unfortunately,
I'm with you. Just stay away from Heathrow.
Pop from Heathrow.
Last question I have. I'm fascinated in your view. I think you've got a really amazing insight into this. What do you think about my sort of perception on the actual messenger themselves? Do you think there's a problem? Like, I can't imagine Keir Starmer or Rachel Reeves being the sort of optimistic.
So here's what I think about Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves. I think fundamentally they are introverts.
Yeah.
And I'm not blaming them.
I just don't think they're able to do
it. I don't think you should have introverts leading the country. And I think the government Labour took a pun on thinking that what people wanted was securenomics. They wanted politics that was light touch. They wanted the economy stabilised. They wanted a bit more money in their pocket. But generally, they wanted the government to leave them alone. But actually, what we're going through is just perma-crisis where public services are in tatters, people's living standards are declining further, people's mental health and physical health is declining further, and actually they need a strong leader.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Keir Starmer at some point in history might have been a good prime minister, but not at this time when it requires a strong degree of leadership and a Labour government prepared to be more radical on tax and spend.
Do you think anyone in that cabinet is that person?
No.
No, neither do I.
There seems to be a real dearth of talent.
Yeah, because I'm just thinking,
that kind of leadership talent.
If I'm looking for someone who can do the sort of Boris Johnson job in terms of communication, I just don't see it in the cabinet. Like, Pat McFadden is even worse than them, and David Lammy's not a great communicator. Wes is pretty good, but... Yeah, he's...
No. Yeah. What about Andy Burnham?
Andy's great, but he just... It's a long way for him to come back into Parliament. No, I don't think so. I don't... I'm looking for a performer. Do you know what I mean? I'm looking for someone who can... that oomph. Do
you think Corbyn had that oomph?
No.
No, I don't either.
No, I think Corbyn was amazing at being able to connect with people on a human level. I think people believed him. The best thing I heard about Corbyn after 2017 was someone who didn't vote for us who told me, I'm not a big fan of him, but I believe he believes what he's saying,
yeah,
and I respect that. I think that's what Corbyn had. But he didn't have the traditional charisma.
But isn't that weird? Because I don't think people felt that about Boris Johnson.
No, I think they did. I think he had a natural charisma.
Mm.
And people thought he was funny. People thought he was entertaining. They like that.
Mm.
Anyway, we'll see. We'll keep our eye on this as the new happiness index data is likely to come out in 2025. That's it from Politics Uncensored today. Join us every Thursday at 5 p.m. where we unwrap this week's political talking points. You can stay up to date with the show by following at Politics Uncensored UK on social media, where you can find me at Ali Milani UK.
And you can find me at Zoe Grunewald on Blue Sky or Instagram.
If you've missed on any today's show, you can listen back and catch up at FUBARradio.com or on the FUBAR Radio app.
Download it from your app store now.
Thanks for listening. See you next week for another episode of Politics Uncensored.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald.